Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you ever think about the European Union? And when you do you think about the European Union, or EU, as it's referred to very often? Have you ever thought about it as being a secular heaven on earth? A secular heaven on earth. Well, there's a book out called The New Totalitarian Temptation, A Global Governance and the Crisis of Democracy in Europe. It's written by Todd. I'm going to mutilate his last name, but it's Huizinga, I think is how you pronounce his last name, Huizinga, Huizinga, and The New Totalitarian Temptation. Well, the Acton Power Blog, the Acton Institute Power Blog, the Sarah Stanley out there, she did a review of this on the blog, and so she talks about it. And in the review here, it notes about all of the failures that are taking place with the EU. And so it's hardly measuring up to this concept about it being this great secular heaven on earth. Well, here to talk with us about that subject is someone who knows Europe very well himself. He's the Associate Professor of Renaissance and Reformation Studies at the Master's College. I'm speaking about Professor Grant Horner. You can find out more about Professor Horner and the Master's College out at their website at www.masters.edu. Professor Horner, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Thanks for having me on, Kevin. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thank you. Well, I know that you have already read this article. I sent it to you ahead of time, but I wanted to get you to walk us through this a little bit. Tell us, what did you think about what the article had to say in general, and then maybe we can talk about a few things more specifically.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting piece. I would actually pair it with a very famous article from 2009 by Charles Murray that was called The Europe Syndrome. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later on, but this is a really interesting take on this book. The idea is that the EU, the European Union, which is essentially all of Europe, all the way down to Greece and up into Great Britain through Scandinavia, down to Spain and Italy, many decades ago formed the EU, the European Union, where they've essentially in some ways kind of not erased the borders, but loosened the borders, gone to essentially a centralized bank and currency system, and moved to kind of limit national sovereignty. In other words, it's kind of moving towards a one Europe government, at least in a certain kind of sense.
Mm.
And what's interesting is that this is being referred to as the EU's soft utopia. And what everybody hears about now is, oh, the happiest place in the world is, if you go and ask the average person on the street, you say, well, obviously it's Scandinavia, it's Sweden and Finland and Norway and Denmark and maybe Iceland. And that it's actually funny enough that that's probably not actually the case. They have the highest rate of antidepressant use in the world. About 10 to 30% of the people at various ages in Scandinavia are on antidepressants. So you have to ask yourself, well, are they on antidepressants because they're depressed people? Are they on antidepressants and that's what's making them claim to be so happy in all these polls?
Huh.
So it doesn't appear that whatever the success of the government, and in a lot of ways it's not working well, it doesn't appear that the people are particularly happy. And what seems to be happening is that this kind of EU soft utopia is in fact moving towards at least potentially a totalitarian form of government.
Hmm. Is that where it always leads in the end? And as you answer that, also tell our listeners about the word utopia. We mentioned it on a previous broadcast, but mm-hmm. I thought the etymology of that I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. One of the books I teach in my literature classes is called Utopia. It was written in 1516 by a guy named Sir Thomas More. And if you've seen the movie or read the book, seen the play, A Man for All Seasons, he was a Catholic leader. He was the chancellor, basically ran England in the early 16th century. He was King Henry VIII's best friend and closest advisor. Eventually, they had a falling out, and Henry VIII had his had his friend's head chopped off. But in 1516, Sir Thomas More wrote a book called Utopia. And in Latin, topos means a place. So we get the word topography and topology. And then U is the letter U, which is a prefix. It's a negating prefix. And so it negates what comes after it in the noun form. So Utopia actually means no place, the place that doesn't exist. And so if you read this very interesting short 16th century book, it's about a mythical land called Utopia. The king is Eutropius, and a guy named Raphael Hitloday sails to Utopia, and he finds this perfect society. But the whole thing is very tongue-in-cheek. It's very ironic and satirical. And what Sir Thomas More was doing is he was saying human beings desperately try to create Utopia on Earth, but it never can be successful, because, you know, Sir Thomas More was essentially a Catholic Christian theist. He believed in the fall of man, the loss of Eden, the loss of paradise, and that man was depraved, and that we would try to make the world better, but we would never fully succeed in basically recreating Eden on Earth.
So it, since it can't be accomplished and people are trying to accomplish it, does it always lead to totalitarianism?
Well, it can do that. There are a lot of different theories about, you know, how government works and what's the best kind of government and why we need government and so on and so forth. One of the most basic ones goes back also into the 17th century in the Renaissance. A guy named Thomas Hobbes wrote a book called Leviathan. And his view was that the monarchy was the best form of government, because what you needed to do was just find a good king who had total power, and he would care for the people that needed to be cared for, and then he would take care of the bad guys. The basic idea in the Hobbesian view of government is that in the state of nature, mankind is having what they call the bellum contris omnia, the war of all against all. And the idea is that people are selfish, self-interested, can be violent, and people will generally take things that they did not produce that are not theirs because they're selfish and lazy. And in order to prevent the world from descending into total anarchy and chaos, you had to give total power to a monarch. So in essence, you give up some of your rights. You can't question the monarch. You can't walk out of court if they're sending you to death. But the monarch will protect you and your property. So the whole theory of government, there are a lot of different ideas about it. But what most people in Europe have dealt with since the 16th and 17th century is, how do we decide what rights to give up in order to be protected by our government? Now, the other article that I mentioned by Charles Murray, I would highly recommend it to all of your listeners. It was written in 2009, and it's very, very interesting. It's called The Europe Syndrome and the Question, or was it the Question of the Problem, and the Challenge to American Exceptionalism. Charles Murray is a brilliant, brilliant kind of social theory thinker. The Europe Syndrome and the Challenge to American Exceptionalism. And what he does is he writes this very well-known article right at the beginning of the Obama presidency. And he says, the Americans are all shaken up because we've essentially elected a European-style social democrat. He says, but if you go to Europe, everyone seems to be fairly happy. They seem to be reasonably free. No one seems to be ground under the heels of an authoritarian, totalitarian dictator. And he said, so you can't critique Europe and say it's not working. But then he said, the real problem is not whether the economic system works or not. He says that what happens is, when you get a powerful centralized government that controls the economy, the military, the laws, and they begin intruding in every area in your life, what happens is they take over, they actually begin to take over the four most important areas in life. He quotes James Madison in Federalist Paper number 62, which says a good government implies two things. First, fidelity to the object of government, which is the happiness of the people. Secondly, a knowledge of the means by which that object can be best attained. And so, according to the early American political thinkers, the goal of government is to allow people all ability to grow into happiness, not prosperity, not security, not equality, happiness, which everyone can define for themselves, at least according to the American system. So what Murray says is, when the government begins to take over the four basic functions that give meaning to life, family, community, vocation, which can be your job or your hobby or the values that you invest in, maybe you work for the Red Cross, and then personal faith, family, community, vocation, faith. What a large centralized government does is it starts taking over those things which give meaning to life. They intrude in your family, tell you how to raise your kid. They educate your kids. They tell you what the rules are in your community. They tell you what you can make as far as income in your job, and they begin to intrude in faith. And he says it strips the vitality and the life out of those four institutions that give meaning to life. And that's what's actually happening to Europe.
Hmm. And what happens in Europe there, it seems to transfer over here to the United States, especially when we have, more left-leaning socialist types that are raised up into leadership here. They look at what's going on over there in Europe as a pattern of what we should implement here in this States, right?
Exactly, yeah. What you'll see with American leftists and a lot of American centrists as well is they say, well, look how well Europe is. It's only been 60, 70 years since World War II, and it's been rebuilt, and they have a fairly vibrant economy, and the people are happy, and they get 8 weeks off paid vacation every year, and free child care, and free education, and free medical care, and this and that and the other thing. Well, those things aren't all entirely true. There's a recent book by Michael Booth called The Almost Perfect People. And it's an analysis of all the claims that the Scandinavians are just live in a perfect society, a perfect utopia, which would not seem to make sense since that part of Northern Europe is cold, dark, wet. They have a very, very short summer, and it never gets above about 50 or 60 degrees. It's very cloudy. It's a very murky area. I mean, the most famous literary character of all time, Shakespeare's character, is a Danish prince who's a famous melancholic depressive. I mean, that's the classic view that people always had of the people from Northern Europe. They live in this depressing area, and they're all unhappy. But now all the claims are that they're incredibly happy. But as I already said, Michael Booth has pointed out, and other people have pointed out, that they have an incredibly high percentage of people on antidepressants. They have terrible problems with heavy alcohol consumption. And the part of what makes their economic system work is that they're in NATO, and a large, large part of our budget is defense, but a large part of our defense budget goes to protecting Europe from outside invaders as well as from, you know, internal problem makers. And so what happens is, in Danish culture particularly, and in Dutch culture particularly, there is a kind of a cultural taboo against anyone ever complaining about anything. So when they're asked in polls, or they're asked by psychologists giving, gathering data, are you happy and how would you rate your happiness? It is expected that you will say, oh, everything is wonderful. But what actually happens is a large number of these people are under psychiatric care. Many of them are depressed and they're on antidepressants. That doesn't seem to me to be much of a formula for success.
No, it's not something we want to look to and say, boy, we need to copy that here. That would be excellent.
Mm-mm.
You know, in this article, it brings up a couple of terms that maybe you could help us understand. It says this, quoting, I think, from the book itself, the New Totalitarian Temptation. It says, from the beginning, the intellectual architects of European integration sought to limit democratic sovereignty in the name of supranational governance. The strategy to advance integration has been dubbed the Monnet method. And so they mention it there. And then further down, there's another one that's called, they speak about constructive ambiguity. Where they're kind of hiding the fact of what they're doing. They don't tell the citizens overtly what's taking place, but they use what they refer to as constructive ambiguity. Explain those and what's taking place and how it relates to what's taking place in Europe currently.
Yeah, well, I spend quite a bit of time in Europe, a number of trips every year, taking students over and teaching art history, cultural history, and things of that nature. And what's really interesting is after a couple of days of taking my students through cathedrals and art museums and through these palaces and just walking through these beautiful streets in Oxford or London or Florence or Rome or Venice or someplace like that, Salzburg in Austria, I ask them some questions and I say, what is your immediate response in the first 3 or 4 days of walking around Europe? And they say, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. I said, but what do you notice? What have you not seen? And then their eyes widen and they go, I haven't seen any children.
Mm.
The fact that most European countries are at a negative replacement rate, in other words, they are producing less children than die each year. The population of native Europeans is shrinking. That is a direct result of these exact kind of policies that are now usually called the Monnet method by Jean Monnet, who's a French theorist of how to set up a government. Essentially, what the Europeans who follow this method want to do is they don't want to erase the different countries, nationalities, and ethnic groups in Europe, but they want to have supranational jurisdiction, some kind of an overarching government like the EU or like the World Court or the International Court in The Hague in the Netherlands, that will have supra-jurisdictional power over the individual nations. In other words, imagine if we had to conform our laws and answer to the United Nations. Now, we're not in a place like that, but imagine if we said to the United Nations that your constitution supersedes ours, and that's what the Monnet methodology is trying to do. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they work at the national level. They try and get people into power who will slowly begin changing incrementally. He uses the word gradualist approach. It's an incremental, bit-by-bit approach. You start with the economy. What you do is you move the economy away from a free market capitalist system, which has its problems. I mean, you know, we're all human beings, and people can be too greedy, and they can do bad things and exploit workers and treat their employees and employers badly and so on and so forth. But in the fallen world, it does seem to lift more people out of poverty than any other system, provide more opportunity than any other system. But what the Monnet people do is they shift a country's economic policies to favor government control of the economic system away from the private sector. And one of the first things that they do is they heavily regulate businesses. One of the second things that they do is they heavily tax corporations. One of the next things they do is they begin very, very heavily taxing individuals who make a high income. And then they try and shift the health system from private sector control to public sector control, basically decentralized medicine. And if any of that sounds familiar, yes, you're seeing it here. America is on a European track, not in every area, but in many areas, has been for about probably 40 to 50 years, really since Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society in the early 60s, which has spent literally trillions of dollars and has had no actual effect on lifting people out of poverty. It simply created a welfare state. So the whole goal of Jean Monnet's system is to make people that are under the, quote, care of the government, but really what it means is if you're under the government's care, you're also under its power, right?
Mm-hmm. In both of those areas.
So what they do is they develop this, you know, he calls it the conscious policy of constructive ambiguity. Okay, for instance, go back several years. If you like your health plan, you can keep your health plan. That clearly is not true. It was not true from the beginning. They knew exactly what they're doing. All the evidence is available. Even the intellectual architect of Obamacare said, hey, we made the 2,000-page statutory law so complex and ambiguous that no one would understand it, and they passed it, and now they're finding out, well, of course you can't keep your doctor. We decide who's your doctor, what do you get, and what do you not get. Mm-hmm. In other words, take a look at the medical system in the Veterans Administration. It's run by the government, and it's riddled with problems.
Mm. Yeah, all of these things that you mentioned before, the four things that you listed under the government, reach into community and family and vocation and faith and so forth. We see that clearly happening on a regular basis in our society today. And now these other things, you know, the regulations, the taxing, hands and fingerprints all over the healthcare system and so forth. We definitely see that happening. So all of these same type of problematic issues or items that we can note over in Europe are actually taking place in some level and maybe even with breakneck speed here in the United States.
Much faster than Europe.
Exactly. Why is that? Why does it take place so much quicker?
Well,
here?
It really took Europe 40 or 50 years to get into the early stages of that. I mean, when West Germany was rebuilt by the Allies, particularly America and Britain after the devastation of World War II, the Marshall Plan essentially demilitarized Germany and set up a very open free market system. And within about 2 years, the black market and the gray market were gone, back at work, and they were rebuilding everything. In West Germany, within 20 years, by the late 50s, early 60s, was the economic powerhouse of Europe. And its economy is the envy of everyone in Europe. It's an absolute powerhouse. But right next door, East Germany was taken over by the Soviet government, under Stalin. And East Germany was economically and socially and culturally destroyed. I mean, that's why they had to build a wall to keep the people from crossing West Germany so that they could have a decent life. Mm. And what's really interesting is that while it took, 50 to 70 years for Europe to move in that direction, what you've seen just under the last, it's been less than a decade, under President Obama, who's definitely the most European-style social democrat that we've had so far, much, much more so than Kennedy or Johnson or even Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton was nowhere near as Europeanized as President Obama has been. Mm-hmm. And so, this coming election is not so much about Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal as what direct, we're very much at a crossroads. Are we going to further Europeanize, or are we going to try and put the skids on it and see if we can turn it around or not? Mm-hmm. And what people often don't understand is all the promises you're going to get from an open socialist Democrat like Bernie Sanders from Vermont,
right,
is that All of these promises, they come at a cost. There is nothing free. When he says you're going to get free college, look, someone's going to pay the professors.
Sure.
Someone's going to pay it. Going to pay them. Someone's going to pay the gardeners on the campus. Someone's going to be paying for the books. It all gets paid for. The question is who. And what always results is you give up your rights. I met a man, a young guy, 26 years old, in Italy just about a month or two ago. We were hiking and we stopped at this beautiful terrace overlooking the Mediterranean on the Amalfi Coast, and it was pretty chilly, and we're like, oh, we wish there was a coffee shop open, and nothing was open. It was a little bit off season, kind of cold and wet and misty, and this guy rolls up with a little cart, and he starts setting it up, and we're like, oh, is this a coffee, a little rolling coffee shop? He says, yes, it'll be open in 15 minutes. So we all had some cappuccino and a little snack, and then we started chatting with him, and I asked him some questions. I said, so tell me about starting your little coffee cart. And he said, well, it's very difficult. I was born in Italy, but I grew up in Orange County, California, because I noticed he didn't have a very strong Italian accent. Mm. And he said, when I came back to Italy, I wanted to start a coffee business, and I had to make a $10,000 payment, not even for a license, just a $10,000 payment to apply to start a business.
Wow.
This is a coffee cart. It's not much bigger than a wagon. He pushed it himself.
Yeah.
It's 10,000 euro, which is about $11,000. And I said, how long from your gross profit will it take you to make that $10,000 back? Because he had just started his business that year. He said, it's going to take me 3 to 4 years of gross profit if my business does well before my gross sales, before I can actually turn that into a profit. And I said, will you keep the business going? He said, I don't know. This is a guy who's hard working.
Wow.
He's an entrepreneur. And he's selling $2 cups of coffee.
I was going to say, that's going to be a lot of cappuccino in order to make that kind of money back.
That's a lot of cappuccino.
Boy. Yeah, let me get your prediction. We just have a couple minutes left. But as we're still cultural cousins together with Europe in many ways, and so we kind of stand and fall together. You think the EU, first of all, you think the EU is going to break up? They're coming to a crisis vote here just very shortly, I think in June. And then secondly, what should we expect here in the United States? Will we see the type of turmoil that's, happening all over Europe going to be here in the United States as well?
Right. It could be. Yeah. In Britain right now, they're calling it Brexit, the British exit from the EU. The Brits are just sick of dealing with the problems of external control. We're much closer to the British in mentality than the rest of Europe. As far as independence, freedom, personal liberty, so on and so forth. Great Britain is not quite as socialized as most other European countries in most areas. So I think that there's a very good chance that that if Britain exits, that Germany will look at it and say, why should we be carrying the ball for places like Greece, where the unemployment rate has soared through the roof and everyone's on welfare and their economy has essentially collapsed. So I think if one or two of the strong powerhouse countries, France, Britain, West Germany, Germany were to exit, then the whole thing would probably collapse. And I don't know that it would produce chaos, but in some ways it would probably be really good, because the countries that have got it together and will run a free market and let people just work hard and receive the gains, receive the rewards for their work, I think those countries will do well. And the ones that are utterly committed to socialism, Greece and certain other countries that are smaller, will probably have some troubles. What will happen in America, God only knows. I mean, if we go more socialist, for me, the biggest thing is not the economic impact or the loss of certain kinds of political freedoms, perhaps. as it would be what's going to happen to the church, because mm-hmm. inevitably the government either takes over the church. You go into these absolutely empty church. I mean, every church building in Scandinavia is immaculately kept up. It's beautiful and it's completely empty because the government's mm-hmm. taken over. It's a Lutheran state church, mm-hmm. and the churches are empty because they're not real churches. They're dead churches.
Right. Just
so I think that it might do a good job to separate, you know, the sheep from the goats, the real Christians from the ones who've just been playing church in America for the last 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very hard to say.
Yeah, be a sifting that will take place. Dr. Horner, thank you so much. Fascinating discussion. Appreciate you coming on the program today to talk about these things, especially with your experience about so often being over there and teaching about these things with your students as well. We really appreciate you being on the broadcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm going back to Italy in 10 days for 2 weeks, and so I'll continue to observe and bring back whatever I can learn.
Well, if you need somebody to carry the luggage or something, just shoot me an email. I'll see what I can work out.
I'll send one right out.
All right, thanks a lot. Thank you so much. There again was Dr. Grant Horner. He's the Associate Professor of Renaissance and Reformation Studies at the Masters College. That's www.masters.edu. I think you just got a really good taste of the type of learning that takes place there. If you got a young person that's looking for a great place to go to college, I highly recommend it. You can see here that you know, they know the subjects very, very well. That was a very good example of it there, of course, with Professor Horner and all that he does. Again, he's the Professor of Renaissance and Reformation Studies at the Masters College. That's www.masters.edu. Remember this, the Lord Jesus Christ said, He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth. To keep this ministry strong and coming your way, you can make a financial gift at knowingthetruth.org by clicking on the donate button.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.